This is the Biblical Mind Podcast, produced by the Center for Hebraic Thought. Honest five-star reviews help others find this podcast. Visit the magazine at thebiblicalmind.org for articles and videos that explore the deep structures of Scripture.
So this story transcends the bounds of a normal story. So we could theoretically take any story in Genesis, the stories of the patriarchs, and say, hey, this is a really important story. You know, these are really important characters in the national history, in the prehistory of the people of Israel. We should be thinking a lot about this particular episode of Abraham or Isaac or Jacob or anyone else in Genesis. But this story has a life that has gone way beyond Genesis. And that's, I think, what makes it such a rich story. It's a story that is situated in the life of Abraham. So it's essentially the climax of the stories of Abraham. I'll say more about that in a second. But it's also a story that in the thousands of years that people, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, since a version of the story is found in the Quran as well, have been reading the story and thinking about it, it's taken on its own life. And the themes of this story almost stand often independent of its context in Genesis. So in Genesis, the story of Abraham essentially starts in Genesis 12 and starts with God telling Abraham, leave your ancestral homeland, leave your father's house, go to a new place. And the first two words of that command to Abraham are in Hebrew, lech lecha, which in the old translations is something like get thee or go for yourself. And then the climactic story of Abraham is Genesis 22, this story of the binding of Isaac, where God says to Abraham, now I want you to take this son whom you've been waiting for decades and decades, and I want you to offer him as a burnt offering. And I think the first person to say this in these terms was Martin Buber. Buber says, when you put these two together, the brackets of Abraham's life, so the first trial of Abraham and the last trial of Abraham, you get the sum total of God saying to Abraham, on the one hand, I want you to forsake your past and abandon everything that you know, where you come from. And on the other hand, at the end, I also want you to give up any hope for the future. I want you to put that aside. There is no future. And as Buber puts it, the ultimate trial for Abraham is God saying to him, can you live entirely in the present just with me? And as much as we today talk about, like, you have to live in the present, you have to not be so future-oriented, actually, if we live only in the present, that's actually pretty terrifying. Right. So in the context of Abraham, this is I think it sort of rounds out this biographic portrait of someone who's being asked to do, like, really unthinkable things, to live a life with God. So that's in the context of Genesis. But as I said, it then sort of takes on a life of its own and goes in all sorts of different directions. And that's those are some of the lines that I pick up in the book and try to pursue. So as I said, it's not just Jewish readers. Because of the whole typology of Isaac being a foreshadowing of Jesus. So, of course, the story of the binding of Isaac, the near sacrifice of Isaac becomes foreshadowing the actual sacrifice of Jesus by his father. What Abraham is willing to do, God actually does. The story of the binding of Isaac is actually, it's alluded to a number of times in the New Testament, but not developed in full terms.
Right. It's not directly cited or quoted in any way.
Right. But, but already by the first, by the late first century, we have church fathers saying that, this is the story that's the type of, that Isaac, I'm sorry, that Jesus fulfilled later on. Thank you.
read this book, Unbinding Isaac, The Significance of the Akedah, which is the name of this passage, the Jewish name for this passage, The Significance of the Akedah for Modern Jewish Thought, Akedah, referring to the binding of Isaac, which I want to talk about in a little bit. As I was reading this book, and then I went and looked up your bio, I think I was about halfway through, and I saw you're a professor of ancient Near Eastern studies, and I have to admit, I was a little surprised. I read a lot of ancient Near Eastern studies. None of it has read like this. So I wonder, what's your actual, like, what do you teach day in and day out? And then how do you see this fitting in with the ancient Near East in general? If you could summarize that and quickly.
Yeah, definitely. Right. It's true. So yeah. Most of my teaching is in ancient stuff. For me, this book is a stretch. Like, I had to, work hard to get some modern philosophy under my belt that I don't typically trade in. But it was a good stretch. I enjoyed it. It's also important, I think, for me. The story of the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, presents philosophical challenges for modern people that I do think the ancient background has something to say about, but there really are modern problems. And that's something that I spend some time on in the book, talking about why these are specifically modern problems. So, coming to it from the ancient context, lots of people since the 19th century, really, since we found out that at least some people in the ancient Near East did practice child sacrifice. And the truth is, this is already, it's mentioned in the Bible. So it's not it's not like it was a secret, but we didn't really know how common it was. We still don't know how common it was, but we know that it happened, more than once or twice. I mean, we have these...
We should point out, it's difficult to know outside of texts that assert that it's happening, because even archaeologically... it's difficult to know if a child is dead and buried under a house,
right?
If their throat was slit, that's not going to be in the bones, right? So,
right. Yeah. That's right. No, the real good evidence actually comes from Phoenician towns outside of the area of the Near East itself, like Carthage, where the Phoenicians went and, settled a new city. And then we got a cemetery that, modern archaeologists call it Tophet, using the biblical name, actually. Where you have something, I think it was like 40,000 kids,
like these horrifying
numbers of children's bones, which some of them are broken. But as you say, it's not so much the pathology of the bones; it's more that they were then collected, burned. They're all they like sort of hover around 6 to 9 months old. Like, it's really sort of chilling to think about the reality behind it, but really pretty clear evidence that there was this practice of child sacrifice that took place, and with some regularity, obviously not all the time. And so the point is that, since for the last 200 years or so, people have been saying, well, think about Abraham's world. Child sacrifice happened in Abraham's world, so what does this story have to say about child sacrifice? And one common view is, this story is the repudiation of it. Like, other people were practicing child sacrifice, and here God says, sacrifice your child. And Abraham's like, okay, that's what everyone else does. I'm going to do it too. And then God says, no, don't do it. And that's, said to be rejecting this idea of child sacrifice. So, I think that there's something to that. I think it's a little bit more complicated than that, but there is some ancient reality that helps to illuminate the story.
I think it's important, though, to say, if that is the interpretation, right, that this is God teaching Abraham child sacrifice is not his way, that also in some way says something about God, in the sense that, the God being described in those texts as like, okay, he's going to use really powerful object lessons, as we would call it today, right? And is that really what's going on? Is that all that's going on in that text? Maybe... there's so many things we could talk about at this point, but maybe we could just step through the text itself and think about what's going on in this story, just to make sure everybody has the details. We can't assume that everybody knows this story as well as maybe the Jewish tradition. And we talked beforehand, like a lot of Christians don't even know the details of the story. They know that it happened, but they might not have paid attention to it. So I'm interested to know what you, as a biblical scholar, ancient Near Eastern scholar, what you think of the text itself, the style of storytelling, because for me it stands out in the book of Genesis as a very differently structured story.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's incredibly laconic and short. I mean, the whole story is 19 verses long. Right. So it packs a punch sort of theologically, ideologically. It's sort of stunning that a 19-line story can occupy people for so many centuries.
Right.
But you know, part of that is in fact the laconic nature of the story. And there's so much is left unsaid that you know, a reader who approaches it assuming that there's something profound going on has a lot of work to do to unpack that. So the story, like really briefly, it starts with God appearing to Abraham, apparently in a dream, although it's never quite explicitly said. And saying, take your son, your only son, the one you love. And it's actually the first time in the entire Bible that we've heard of anyone loving someone else. And it's kind of chilling because take your son whom you love and go offer him as a burnt offering on a mountain that I'll show you.
Just before that, we should point out that the narrator's preface is, and he tested Abraham, right? So
yes.
There's no doubt this is a test.
Yes,
stated up front, yeah.
That's correct. So Abraham packs up his stuff, it takes the knife, the fire, two attendants, goes off with Isaac, they walk for 3 days. At some point he sees the place. It's not ever said how he knows where the place is, but he sees the place. He then leaves his attendants behind, as you guys stay here. And we, Isaac and I, are going to go up to the mountain. We will prostrate ourselves, we'll bow down, and then we will come back. Isaac, walking with his father, sort of notices that like something's up, and he's like, well, it looks like we're going to sacrifice. You know, we have the wood, we have the fire, but we don't have a sacrifice. There's no sheep here. And Abraham offers what seems to me like a very enigmatic answer. It says, God will see for himself the sheep, right, my son? And then it leaves it at that.
For a lot of modern English translations, it'll say God will provide. So it actually says see it, and we kind of infer a see to it kind of gloss on that. So
because you know, without sort of glossing it in some way, it's really unclear. And I'm not convinced that it's not unclear, but it's unclear whether Abraham had just answered the question, avoided the question, obliquely given Isaac a clue, but it's really not totally clear what the dynamics of that conversation were. And it seems really important because that is the only dialogue between Abraham and Isaac in this story. Like, that's the only question Isaac asks. It seems like a really, you know, sort of simple, innocent question. And the answer is not, it's at least not straightforward. And, you know, it seems like there could have been more straightforward ways of answering the question. So it certainly seems like needs interpretation.
I shouldn't laugh because this is like, it's describing a horrifying scene.
Right.
But there is a way of reading this of like dark comedy. Like, I see the fire and I see the knife. Like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
I wonder what do you think would be the more direct way? Like, hey, I'm getting ready to kill you.
You know, right. So it's really fascinating. One of the things, you know, we talked about the laconic nature of the story. Like, one of the things that's missing from the story that seems really important once you start thinking about it is just some notice of how old Isaac is. Like, if he's 7, then that's a reasonable question for a 7-year-old. Like, hey, Dad, you know, I've done sacrifices with you before. I see some of the stuff here, but like, where's the sheep? And the dad could be like, you know, some kind of question when the kid asks like a question that's too hard or, you know, inappropriate for it now. So that's something that like sounds more or less like an answer, but like hopefully the kid will just stop asking questions. Yeah. So that's reasonable if he's 7, but there's nothing in the text about his age. And in the very next chapter, he is sort of quick arithmetic tells you that he's 37.
Right.
So, you know, some readers in antiquity were already taking him to be an adult. You know, we have some texts, some midrash texts, some rabbinic texts that say he's 25. Some say he's 30. He is 37 already. That doesn't really matter. But if he's an adult, then I think you're right. Like, you know, then when he says, "Hey, where's the sheep for the sacrifice?" That's not like an innocent, sweet kid noticing something's up. But like, wait a second, what's going on here? And it also raises the possibility that when Abraham gives a sort of enigmatic answer, that it's basically a way of cluing Isaac in, like, you get it, right? Like, you get it.
Right.
Which is one way that people have read the story, that Isaac is now a fully willing participant after that dialogue. Like, he knows, and, you know, the next words are the two of them walk together, which means that Isaac, even knowing what he's going to do, he's in this as much as his father is.
Right. Which begs the question of what's the purpose of the binding?
Yeah, so they get to the mountaintop, and then, as you say, like, the binding seems really interesting. Again, you know, if he's a little kid, then you can imagine Abraham sort of binding him against his will. If he is an adult, then he has to presumably be willing to be bound, because remember that in the biblical narrative, Abraham is 100 years older than Isaac. So it's sort of difficult to imagine
right.
125-year-old man overpowering a 25-year-old man. So the, you know, the ages are hard to wrap our heads around anyway, but just a narrative logic, like, you know, he has to be sort of hopping up on the altar and like, okay, here in my hand.
And I think it's fair. I think a lot of people might want to massage the details at this point, but we're going to say, like, look, the narrator is asking you to imagine a scene here. And so you have to supply some of this when you imagine the scene.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I tell my students, you know, if you want to realize all the gaps in this particular story, so pretend you're a director staging it.
Right, right.
And immediately you're faced with all these questions that, you know, you realize, oh, the text never told us that, the text never told us that, and you have to decide how to stage it.
That's good.
So, yeah, I mean, there are texts, you know, again, from ancient times. Maybe the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's sort of a little bit fragmentary at this point, but certainly from some later Aramaic texts that have Isaac saying, "Tie me well, Dad,
right.
because I don't want to like jerk my body around, and then the sacrifice would be unacceptable because the cut on the neck would be jagged," which is a horrifying thing to imagine someone saying, but you know, they're willing to put it in his mouth. They're like, they're trying to think this through in sort of concrete terms. Like, what does it actually look like once he's on the altar? I guess the you know, the good thing is that whatever he may or may not have said, then an angel of God shows up and says, he actually calls Abraham twice, "Abraham, Abraham." Abraham says, "Here I am." And the angel says, "Don't do it. Don't hurt him. Don't do anything to him." That's actually all he says there. Abraham doesn't do anything. We're never actually told that he unties him.
Right.
We assume he untied him at some point. And then Abraham notices that there's a ram caught in the thicket. He takes the ram, offers that as a sacrifice. It's sort of little noticed detail that Abraham was never told to offer the ram in place of Isaac. Like, that seems like his initiative. It sounds like, from the angel's perspective, Abraham was just sort of free to go. Like, you don't have to offer a sacrifice. But he offers the ram instead. The ram, of course, becomes an important type for early Christians as well. And then the angel shows up again and says, "Listen, because you did that, because you didn't withhold your son from me, you're going to get a lot of reward. Your children will be successful militarily and materially." And then there's like a little bit of a divine speech there. And then Abraham, and this is the last line in the story. It says that Abraham went down the mountain, returned to his attendants, and they all went back to Beersheba, where he had been living. So that's the story.
And probably something was told to the mother, we don't know, right?
Right. So that's actually me. I've been playing with that more recently, actually. Yeah, Sarah's role is really enigmatic, and you know, I'd say just that readers for a long time ago already noticed that, like, she's missing, and what would that mean for her to be back in the story? Like, what would Abraham have said to her in the morning? If she's like, you know, like in the show Hamilton, before Hamilton's duel, he says to his to Eliza, just like, "Oh, I have an early morning meeting at dawn. To be out of town. I'll be back. I'll be back soon."
Don't worry. So
you know, he seems to think that she couldn't handle knowing where he was going. So there are some texts that sort of say the same thing, that Abraham like couldn't have told Sarah because she couldn't have handled it. And other texts, actually, there's a lot of early Christian texts, Syriac in particular, that have Sarah essentially yelling at him because she wants a part of this also. She's like, "This is the most righteous thing you've ever done. Why are you not including me?" So it's interesting to imagine it. It's hard to, but the text totally ignores her in this story.
You talk about in the book, you spend a chapter or more talking about how this text, because it's famously laconic, it almost becomes a Rorschach test for people's theology or their sense of who God is or who we are. So maybe you could just walk through, why this story is so important to Jews, and that and often Christians don't know it unless it has to do with their view of Jesus. And then B, what are some, like, some of the most outstanding reactions to this text or interpretation of the text that come to your mind?
So there are a couple of different reasons for why the text has loomed so large. One of them, which I do spend some time on, is actually pretty tragic. It's that every time Jews had a period of history where there were a significant number of Jewish martyrs dying for their faith, or less commonly, but more horrifically, killing their children for faith. I'll give you examples in a second.
Yeah.
They looked back at this story as the story that shows that this is something that sometimes God may demand. And it's sort of beside the point whether we think that's in fact the meaning of the story in its context in Genesis right now, because the emotional power that it packed was enough that, like, you know, people were not getting into like philological arguments at that point.
Right.
Like, well, that's not exactly what it says in Genesis. You know, this is an episode that just sort of colored the way Jews thought about death for faith. And I think it's worth emphasizing that there actually are no stories of martyrdom in the Hebrew Bible. So the closest we get to sort of what we typically think of as martyrdom are in the book of Daniel, where we have, you know, Daniel himself being thrown into the lion's den, or his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who are thrown into a fiery furnace. But of course, those are like near martyrdoms, but they don't die. Like, no one actually dies for faith in the Hebrew Bible.
Samson would be the only person I can think of, but there's so many problems there.
Yeah, and it's not exactly faith in the same way, right? Exactly. There are, there are people who die nationalistically,
right?
But this idea of someone, you know, an oppressor saying something like, "Either you recant your faith or you die," and choosing death is just something that we don't find anywhere in the Hebrew Bible, except for those stories in Daniel where it doesn't happen. Like, those stories seem to say, and it's great because if you don't recant your faith, God will actually save you, so you get the best of all worlds. So of course, you know, early Christians had, unfortunately, lots of martyrdom stories, and rabbinic literature has martyrdom stories. Rabbi Akiva is probably the most famous one, who goes to his death almost happy that he's able to finally, like, fulfill the commandment of loving God with his soul. But
this is the same Akiva, compiler of the Talmud.
Major figure in the
Talmud. Yeah.
A major figure. So when Jews unfortunately did have martyrdoms, and, you know, this looms large first, I think, in the time of the First Crusade, So this is, you know, the First Crusade starts in 1095, and the target, of course, is for these essentially Western European Christians to go to the Holy Land and wrest control back from the Muslims. But a small percentage, and really is, you know, it's pretty clear that a very small percentage of the Crusaders sort of had this thought process that, like, well, before we go to the Holy Land and fight the infidels there, there are infidels in our midst. There are Jews living here in Germany and Eastern France, and we should take care of them first. Mm-hmm. Some Crusaders also just thought the Jews were like a great source of funds because, you know, crusading is expensive. Like, if you're going
right.
to, you know, have to fund yourself the next 4 or 5 years, you have to, you know, buy food and a horse and armor and whatever. So for a bunch of different reasons, the Jews in Central Europe wound up suffering pretty significantly in the beginning of the First Crusade, and in particular in Germany, and particularly there were these terrible stories that were recorded by chroniclers at the time, where Christians would say, you know, some of these crusaders would gather around. Usually the Jews would find refuge in, you know, a fortress in the town because the governor or the mayor was actually a, you know, nice guy, and the Jews had always had like fairly stable relationships. But some band of crusaders would come and say, you know, listen, we need to take the children, raise them as Christians, and then you can all go back home. And some Jews, we have like sort of estimates of the number of people who died, but we don't actually know percentages. Some Jews actually made this pretty horrific choice to actually kill their own children rather than allow them to be raised as Christians. And we have these contemporary chronicles written in Hebrew by Jews, which are, of course, you know, based on what was really happening, but they're literary works. They're not dry chronicles. And they constantly are not just alluding to, but explicitly invoking this story of the near sacrifice of Isaac as a time where we see the patriarch being asked to kill his own child for faith in God. And sometimes that's just enough. Like, they just say, like, oh, this is, you know, like Abraham, except it's worse than Abraham because Abraham got his son back in the end, and these people didn't get their sons back or children back in the end. And sometimes they also use that as the language of theological outrage. They say, you know, like, God, you stepped in and you actually saved Isaac. Why are you not saving these kids? You know, there's one line in one of the chronicles that says 1,100 akedot, like 1,100 child sacrifices in one day, and the angel is silent. Like, what's going on with that?
Wow.
So this, you know, I think that sort of use has seared the story into Jewish collective memory, maybe more than its biblical context would have necessitated.
Yeah. And one can't help notice that as you get not too far into the book, even in the introduction, you introduce the main bad guy, the baddie, as it's in the UK, who Christians love to love, Kierkegaard, or Kierkegaard. Right? So what damage do you think, and we'll just say the Kierkegaardian tradition of translating this, because it's not just him, of course, but what is that tradition, and what damage does that do in maintaining his view of this sacrifice?
Right. So he's, I mean, I should say, I love him also.
right.
He's like a stunning thinker. I mean, he's, you know, really amazing how deeply he thought about being a person of faith in the modern world. Yeah, in this particular one, he took this interesting turn. So I try to argue that this is sort of indicative of his broader thought, but it doesn't really matter so much right now, I think, for our conversation, you know, how deeply rooted this is in his approach. The way he's understood, and I think he's more nuanced than this, but the way he's been understood in the, you know, 200 years since he wrote or so, was basically that this story is a story of a clash between ethics on the one hand and faith on the other. And he has a particular definition of what ethics means. It's, you know, essentially anything that I can articulate the rationale for. So if I can explain to you why I'm doing something, that is an ethical act. You don't have to agree with me. You know, we can disagree on whether it's the right thing to do or not. But if we can talk about it, then that's already within the realm of ethics. And this story for Kierkegaard, I like your Danish, Kierkegaard. That's great.
I spent a little time in Denmark, and they quickly corrected. Well, in the military, yeah. And I said, "Oh, Kierkegaard is from Denmark," and they're like, "Kierkegaard." It's like, okay.
Right. It's funny. yeah. So he's the way he's been understood is that, you know, basically Abraham had to choose between all of the sort of reasonable, ethical, universal considerations on the one hand, like, I love my child, it's wrong to kill innocent children, like pretty straightforward, obvious things. So those all militate against him actually going and killing Isaac as a sacrifice. And on the other hand, you have faith. And faith for, I'm going to go with the American Kierkegaard, for Kierkegaard is just inarticulable. Like, he can't even explain what that means. Like, if you had asked Abraham, what are you doing? He would have been like, trial. Mm-hmm. And that's really all he could say. And he couldn't explain why a trial or why faith would lead him to put aside all of these, like, really obviously deeply important things like love and devotion and, you know, the prohibition against murder and things like that. And for Kierkegaard, this story then says, like, well, we as readers have to choose. Either we agree then that sometimes faith demands that we put ethics aside and do things that are out of the realm of ethics, or we condemn Abraham as a murderer. And since Kierkegaard is a good Christian, and he's writing essentially to other good Christians, he knows that that's a sort of rhetorical question. Like, obviously, we're not going to condemn Abraham as a murderer. So that means that we have to agree that there is a place in this world for putting all of ethics aside and following faith essentially blindly and in a way that I can't even explain to anyone else why I'm doing it. So as I said, Kierkegaard himself is pretty nuanced, but in modern Jewish thought, and I actually don't think this has happened, but please correct me if I'm wrong, in 20th century Christian thought. But in modern Jewish thought, we have a stream of tradition that's essentially taken Kierkegaard and said, yep, that's right. Jewish law demands sometimes, or in some versions always, that we not pay attention to ethics. Like, ethics are just unimportant when it comes to religion, because the story of the binding of Isaac, as Kierkegaard articulated for us, teaches us that faith in God demands that we not worry about ethics and instead just follow God. And that, I think, is first of all, just a modern framing of the question. Like, I don't think anyone in the ancient world would have recognized this question. So, right. You know, I think it's pretty anachronistic to think that way. But it's also, I think, just very dangerous to think this way, because it's taken this this coloring on in recent Jewish thinkers that, you know, there's essentially no reason to worry about ethics. Like, and again, I don't think Kierkegaard would agree with much of this, but I don't have to worry about the ethics of interpersonal relationships or gender egalitarianism, or like, what do I think about same-sex marriage? And be like, is that an ethical question? No, I don't have to worry about ethics, because when it comes to religious questions, the story of the binding of Isaac tells me that I put ethics aside and I just follow faith. And that has taken a dark turn. And I think that's, you know, it's one of the reasons I got motivated to stretch to write this book, was that I saw this sort of stream of thinking in modern Jewish thought. And I was like, this is, you know, I think it's not a great reading of the story. And right. I think it's really dangerous. So that combination, I thought, was sort of worth tackling.
And certainly, in case any listeners don't know, the Shoah, the Holocaust, as it's also called, has figured prominently in all Jewish thinking, as it should. How has Holocaust or the reactions to the Holocaust entered into this discussion as well?
It's actually hard to be totally sure about it. Obviously, you know, there are lots of thinkers during and after the Shoah, who have invoked or appealed to the Akedah in various ways. But actually, you know, some of the most interesting ones, there's one actually that our mutual friend Jim Diamond has written about. The man who was called the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto, Kalonymous Kalman Shapira, who wrote in the hell of the Warsaw Ghetto. He wrote these sermons, and he appeals to this story, but he appeals to it essentially to say that the paradigm has just been shattered by what's going on around him. I think one of the, this is not a generalization that's always true, but I think some of the most sort of chillingly interesting streams of thought about the Shoah are the ones that sort of look at this and say, there's actually nothing beforehand that explains this paradigm. Like, this is not a fulfillment of something. This is not another example of something. You know, we could talk about the First Crusade and we could say, hey, the First Crusade, you know, there are these massacres in, you know, in Spain in 1391 and in Poland in 1648. And unfortunately, like, you know, these are years that are sort of etched into Jewish collective memory. But then you look at like 1943 and you're like, no, this is not like another one of those. We're not talking about, you know, some bad people who got up and unfortunately massacred a few thousand Jews and then we move on with life. Like, this is just shattering all the paradigms. So the Akedah is definitely invoked, but it's sometimes invoked to say, you know, this doesn't prepare us for that. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't prepare us for this. Like, this just doesn't work anymore. It certainly has been part of the vocabulary of trying to process it, but not really, I think, a productive lens for seeing it.
Yeah. I wonder, you, Dr. Aaron Kohler, what, you know, if we have a largely Christian audience listening in mostly the Anglo-American world, what would you like people to understand about the Akedah, or what misunderstanding might you like to correct that would help them understand why this is such an important text for all of us?
So in the book, there's essentially two claims besides the tracing the history, which I think is just, you know, fascinating. And I think on a human level, really gripping. And I sort of hope I did justice to some of that material because it's just such an amazing material. I felt like, you know, my job is just to sort of not mess it up and let people see how remarkable it's been. But there have been two claims. So one is that Kierkegaard's reading that faith asks us to put ethics aside is sort of awe-inspiring in a sense, but also potentially really misleading in another sense. And we certainly shouldn't just take that as the meaning of the story, like, oh, this story teaches us that. So that is sort of goal number one, is sort of subvert this Kierkegaardian. Again, in Jewish circles, I think it's almost like a monopoly. Like, people think about the Akedah, they're like, oh, did you read Kierkegaard? You know, he says, you know, it's almost a joke that, like, a lot of, you know, Jewish, I guess the Yiddish term would be balabatim, which literally means homeowners, but just means sort of like regular folks, you know, not philosophers. Yeah. Who have, you know, never opened a work of 19th century philosophy, all know Kierkegaard because the story of the Binding of Isaac is the Torah reading on Rosh Hashanah, on the New Year. And like all these rabbi sermons start talking about this guy Kierkegaard, who's, you know, looms so strangely famous in the Jewish mentality.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. It's sociologically really fascinating. So goal number one is sort of say, like, look, let's just, you know, Kierkegaard's great, but he's not the authoritative interpreter of the story. And I think he's problematic for a couple of reasons. The other one, you know, the reading that I offered in place of Kierkegaard, actually does go back to this question of child sacrifice that we talked about at the beginning and offers, I'll give you the nutshell version of this, the argument that, I'm kind of scared to say it in a nutshell because I think I'm going to say things that people may or may not like, but I'll say it as follows. That God actually is a complicated character in Genesis, and that it's not fair to say God doesn't like child sacrifice. In fact, God does like child sacrifice in the same way that I really like junk food. Well, that's trivialized. I don't mean to say in the same way exactly, but in the same sense that I like junk food. But I try not to eat junk food because it's bad for me. And in the same way, God likes child sacrifice, but for even more important reasons, doesn't want child sacrifice. Like, he's tempted by it. He thinks it would be an awe-inspiring thing for worshipers of God to offer their children as sacrifices. But there are even better reasons why he refuses the act of child sacrifice. I think that's sort of the dynamic of the story, that he asks Abraham, hey, why don't you offer your son as a sacrifice? You know, this one son that you've always wanted, that you love, offer him as a sacrifice. And Abraham is willing to do that. And God is thankful and acknowledges that Abraham deserves credit for that. But at the end of the day, God says, actually, don't do it. Not for trivial reasons, but because what I try to argue at the end of the book is that there's a really important principle here, that the Torah, is the certainly in the five books, the Pentateuch, seems to be pretty consistent on insisting on, which is that that a child actually has independent value as a human being, as a spiritual being, as a person with a relationship with God on their own, not just subjugated to their parents. So this is actually opening up like a pretty fundamental question, I think, anyone who's a parent or a child, which, you know, essentially includes all human beings with.
Right. anybody who's known a parent or child.
Right, exactly. You know, it's a fraught question. Like, we all know that parents have to make decisions for their children. They're entitled to make decisions. It would be irresponsible not to make decisions for their children. But there's also limits to, like, well, when is that trampling on a child's autonomy? When is the child too old? When is that too personal? So in the Jewish tradition, you know, circumcision is a time where I think a lot of parents think about this when they have sons. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this poor kid is 8 days old and we're stamping them physically in a way that's irreversible. Mm-hmm. There's a temporary pain, but it's more like we're really willing to manipulate, change someone's body in a irreversible way for them without their consent. Not to mention the covenantal part of, like, we've just decided that you're going to be Jewish for the rest of your life.
Right.
And it's a tough question. But I think the story here is essentially saying, like, look, child sacrifice only works logically if you assume that the child belongs to the parent and that the parent therefore has the right to offer the child in the same way that they have the right to offer their sheep. But if you reject that and say, actually, a child stands independently, at least in some ways, then it just falls apart. Like, Abraham can't offer Isaac as a sacrifice. Doesn't matter whether he's 5 or 7 or 25 or 37. Isaac is his own person and stands independently facing God. And God basically says to Abraham, a sheep, a ram, great, fantastic. You know, the PETA people might not like that either, but you know, fine, you own that sheep in that sense. But your child, I might say, is your child. That doesn't mean that you own the child. And that means that you can't offer the child a sacrifice. And essentially, like, your religiosity, your piety can't come through doing violence to your child.
I should point out here that we have a book, a list of notable books for 2020 that we're compiling from our fellows for the Center for Hebraic Thought. And many of them listed this book, Unbinding Isaac, The Significance of Akedah for Modern Jewish Thought, by Dr. Aaron Kohler, as on their list. So this is a great book. I highly recommend it. Dr. Aaron Kohler, thank you so much for your time.
It was really a pleasure, Dr. Johnson. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Biblical Mind podcast, exploring the deep structures of Christian scripture. For more, visit the magazine at thebiblicalmind.org. Subscribe to this podcast at all the usual places so you never miss an episode.